Right now at the Home Depot, you'll save up to 35% off appliance special buys, like a GE appliance's top load washer and dryer pair. With deep clean and deep rinse options, a reliable heavy-duty agitator, and four precise water levels, just $4.78 each. Wash, dry, save, repeat. Today is the day for doing. With Spring Black Friday savings, now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. Gas, dry, extra. See store for details. Valid through April 17th.
Welcome everyone to Creating a Family, talk about infertility. Today's show is fibroids and other uterine issues. This month is Fibroid Awareness Month, and in honor of Fibroid Awareness Month and the fact that so many women suffer from this condition, this is a really timely show. I think you're going to enjoy it, but whether you learn as well as become more aware for even if you don't have fibroids. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear.
You have to keep in mind that the uterus itself is small, but the area where an embryo implants is even smaller. It's essentially the upper half of the uterus, so it's 1 centimeter from the top of the uterine cavity to the midpoint of the uterine cavity and about 1.5 centimeters across. I mean, it's literally the size of a postage stamp. So if you were to have a 1 centimeter polyp that's sitting right where the embryo wants to grow, that could be a problem.
This show is brought to you by Creating a Family. We are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am your host and the director of Creating a Family, and you can find us online at creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. They have a free program they want you to know about called My Fertility Navigator. This program offers free one-on-one support for women who are struggling to get pregnant, and they're not sure of their next steps. So once they enroll in My Fertility Navigator, they will receive a personalized guidance from a real-life human being, their fertility navigator, who can provide important information about fertility in general, as well as give them a list of nearby fertility centers, because we all know that getting into treatment is crucial. Information about financial resources, and just talk about the various options that they may have presented to them. You can get more information about this program at their website, myfertilitynav.com. That's myfertilitynav.com. Today we're going to be talking about fibroids and other uterine issues that impact women. Our guest is Dr. Tamoy Mukherjee. He is a board-certified gynecologist and reproductive endocrinologist and a founding partner with RMA of New York. Welcome, Dr. Mukherjee, to Creating a Family. We're so glad to have you here to talk about this really important topic.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think, as it's always a good idea, we do have to start at the beginning. So let's just, I think most people listening are going to know what a uterine fibroid is, but let's go ahead and tell us what, let's start with that. What is a uterine fibroid?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that fibroids are very common. 50% of women have them. So the first time that you hear that you have a fibroid, it may be a little bit unsettling, but I always like to start with that to reassure. Now, let's take a step back. The uterus is a muscular organ, and its job is to have a lot of blood flow, provide nutrition to a developing pregnancy, create a healthy endometrial lining monthly to permit a pregnancy. So a fibroid is a hard nodular growth in this muscular wall. Fibroids can have different locations. They can be inside the uterine cavity, in the wall, outside the wall. The majority of fibroids are asymptomatic, and they don't cause a problem. But fibroids, these nodular growths that are in the uterine cavity, are a problem. It'll act like an IUD. It's a foreign object inside the uterus that sets up an irritation, a sterile inflammation that keeps a pregnancy from successfully attaching. Or if it's in the wall of the uterus, now the uterus, you think of it as a triangle with the lower end that is on top of the vagina, and the upper part of the triangle opens out into the fallopian tubes, which pick up the egg. So if you have a fibroid that's in the upper portion of the uterus near the entrance to the fallopian tube, it can occlude the tube. So those very specific anatomic issues in those cases, fibroids can be a problem.
Let me ask you a question. The location of the fibroid makes a difference. If it's near the, if a fibroid is blocking the tube, then obviously that's going to be a problem because the embryo has fertilized inside the fallopian tube and then can't get to the uterus. What about if a fibroid is located near the vaginal canal or the cervix? So would that interfere with the actual birth or a vaginal birth?
It all depends on the size of the fibroid. That's a great question. So if you have and this is by size, if that fibroid's bigger than, let's say, a tennis ball and it's in the lower segment, then a delivery may be complicated. But if it is, in the majority of cases, fibroids are only maybe 1 or 2 centimeters, it really doesn't matter.
So if a fibroid
you can just leave it alone.
Okay. So if a fibroid is inside the uterine wall, inside the muscle that is the uterus, it is and it is not projecting into the uterine cavity, then it is less likely to interfere with conception. Did I understand you correctly on that?
Correct. Conception and carriage of pregnancy. If it's a small fibroid in the wall, doesn't enter, doesn't block a tube, you just keep an eye on it, you note it, you see how big it is, and that's it. You leave it alone.
But does it and I kind of want to segue into talking about the main symptoms of fibroids, and so I'd like to let's talk about that. Then I want to ask if it matters where it's located as to what the symptoms are. So let's talk about first, though, generally. What are the primary symptoms most women will experience if they have a uterine fibroid?
Primary symptoms are heavy vaginal bleeding on or about the time of the menstrual cycle, pain with menses as well. When the uterus contracts, the fibroid can increase pain. In very rare cases, if the fibroid gets extremely large, frequency of urination, because if the fibroid grows in the anterior portion of the uterus, that's where the bladder is. So it can push up against the bladder and increase urinary frequency because the bladder can't get that big. Rarely, if the fibroid is really large, we're talking about 10 centimeters, bigger than a grapefruit, if it's on the back wall of the uterus, then you push in against the colon. And then you can have issues as far as voiding or stooling. So, again, it's not a cancer of fibroid. It is just a nodular bit of tissue that's growing into the muscle. And its precise location and size can create a number of different symptoms. You can have a small fibroid the size of a pea or a grape in the uterine cavity that causes a lot of vaginal bleeding. So that's an outsized symptom in relation to the size of the fibroid. But it's in the uterine lining, so that uterine lining is completely around it. And when you're menstruating, it's causing an irritation and increasing the amount of flow.
So the size of the fibroid is not necessarily related to the degree of symptoms.
Correct. It's its location as well. So you can have a small intracavitary fibroid that causes a lot of vaginal bleeding. But if that same-sized fibroid was in the wall or outside the wall, then you'd be completely asymptomatic.
Okay, we got a question from Lisa. She said, I have fibroids, and my main symptom is extremely heavy cycles. Are tampons safe to use? I'm reading stuff about how they have been tested and found to have harmful chemicals in them. Are the sponge and cup safe to use or better to use? I think Lisa asks a question that a lot of women with fibroids, because they often will have heavier menstrual cycles, they have more questions about how to deal just with menstruation in general. So let's talk about tampons, her question on tampons. She asked, really, I think, two questions. One, are they safe? But the second one, I'm not sure if this is the only reason she's worried about safety, but she is asking about, she's read about tests that indicate that there are harmful chemicals found in tampons.
Well, the majority of the products out there, you know, have been tested, and you know, recent review of the literature looking at, you know, various products as far as during a regular menstrual cycle, it's not in relation to fibroids specifically, that shows that tampons are as safe as a cup, as safe as other methods. Now, it's really a matter of personal choice what you're comfortable with. At this point, I would not worry about tampon use when you're having bleeding associated with fibroids.
Okay, so tampons, or if you prefer the sponge or the cup or anything, any of them are fine, whatever works. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly, whatever you're comfortable with,
Yeah. And whatever controls keeps the bleeding from breaking through, quite frankly, because that's more of an issue when you've got...
Well, one of the things that we ask is, you know, again, it's all based on symptoms. The decision to intervene, medical or surgical intervention, is based on symptoms. Menorrhagia or heavy vaginal bleeding is one of the indications to consider therapy. Simply because, you know, quality of life, or if your blood count is too low. I ask a patient how many, you know, pads or tampons or, you know, how many during your menstrual cycle are you using? And if it's onerous where, you know, I can't work, I'm missing work, or my blood count is lower because of it, I mean, that's a reason to consider therapy.
Yeah, okay, and we will move to that in just a moment about what your options are for therapy. Before we get there, though, who is most at risk for having fibroids? Are all women, is it an equal opportunity curse?
It is. In fact, 50% of women will have a fibroid of one type or another. It's that pervasive. It almost seems to be something that naturally arises in the uterus. But the majority of these fibroids are either small, or they're located in a position that's not clinically significant. So fibroids are indeed very common. And again, the other thing that I want to emphasize is just because you have an incidental finding of a fibroid, it's not an indication for surgery. It really does matter on your symptoms, location and size. So that's an important thing to remember as far as fibroids go.
We have done shows on fertility issues in the African American community, and we certainly know that African Americans are at a higher risk. What is the, from a risk standpoint, for, you said in for the general population it's 50%. Do you happen to know what it is for African American women?
It is greater, and it's also in with a family history. I mean, if you're going through the family history, and my mom had it, and my sister, I mean, that goes up to about 75%.
So there is a strong genetic connection then with uterine fibroids? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Now, you have mentioned that that fibroids are not always a problem requiring treatment, that it depends on their size and their location, and quite frankly, what your symptoms are, and I suppose in your tolerance of those symptoms. So, so all of that would matter. So is the speed the fibroid is growing something to worry about?
Yes. Fibroids rarely grow rapidly. My initial recommendation when I note a fibroid is I catalog them, I see what their sizes are, and I write them down. And if I see the patient in 6 months to a year and a fibroid has doubled in size, that's a concern. Fibroids are typically indolent. They grow very slowly. And the majority of fibroids seldom become cancerous. In fact, these cancerous and non-cancerous fibroids have a completely different genetic footprint. So once you have a fibroid and it's been there and it's stable, it's very unlikely to become a cancerous fibroid. A cancerous fibroid pretty much starts out from the beginning with a specific genetic signature that suggests that it will become a malignancy down the road, and these are usually rapidly growing fibroids. So again, if something doubles in size within 6 months, that is an unusual behavior for a fibroid.
And then that's one reason you would want to be tracking that, because although it's extremely rare, it is possible to have fibroids and to have cancer, a cancerous one. Are women with fibroids more prone to or more susceptible to other reproductive tract cancers?
No. If we're talking about cervical or ovarian cancers, no. Endometrial cancers, which are cancers of the uterine lining, are a little bit more difficult to diagnose because you already at baseline have increased vaginal bleeding. So clinicians may sometimes, you've had fibroids for years and you've had abnormal vaginal bleeding for years, so they may not be as quick to biopsy the uterine lining when you have fibroids simply because, well, that's part of your history. You've always had this kind of issue. But
you have an excuse for the symptom, and so the symptom does not seem like it would not necessarily
But it's not
point
because those cancers are more common. It's because they are underdiagnosed because clinicians, you've had fibroids. I expect you to have some bleeding. But really, they should be biopsied immediately if they have irregular bleeding.
Yeah, I suppose that's the, you know, the when in West Texas and you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras.
Exactly.
You know, when you're seeing somebody who has got heavy bleeding and they have already had heavy bleeding because of fibroids, it doesn't stand out as a new symptom. So you're thinking, you know, the horse, which is the fibroid, not the zebra, which is the cancer.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's always biases. And in medicine, that's one of the biases that we always have to be careful of, diagnostic bias. When you assign somebody a diagnosis, and then your thought process always goes back to that diagnosis. So there is a bias there, and you have to be careful of
it. Sure. Yeah, well, yeah. And it makes sense, too. So you've talked about the fact that if you have a fibroid, nothing to overreact to. It is there, and you're going to be watching the symptoms, and you want to go back to your doctor. With some frequency, it sounds like, just to make certain that it's not growing. Should a woman with fibroids change any of her routine medical practices, go see the doctor more often, do anything along those lines?
Well, I would suggest after the initial diagnosis of fibroids that the follow-up visit be in 6 months, and if that visit shows that nothing really has changed, then I would go to an annual visit. But I would suggest annual visits after that initial diagnostic phase, observation phase has been completed. And then if something changes, you know, you go to your initial consult, it's like, I usually bleed for about 7 days, which is kind of excessive, but your blood count is normal and you're not going through, you know, 10 pads a day. But it's manageable, your blood count's stable. If that changes, if all of a sudden I'm bleeding for 14 days, or I'm using 20 pads a day, you got to go back to your physician immediately. Or I'm having more pain, or I'm urinating more frequently. If something changes in the characteristic of your symptoms, you should go back. But if everything is stable, you should be fine.
Are there lifestyle factors that contribute to development of uterine fibroids? Or I guess to say it another way, are there lifestyle changes that women should make if they have them?
That's a great question. I get asked that all the time.
Yeah, I bet you do get that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the data out there does not show that there is a dietary. I mean, definitely there's an ethnic influence, family history influence, age influence. But as far as diet, doesn't seem to be anything. Whether you're vegan or pescatarian, across the different dietary spectrums that are out there, doesn't seem to be a change in the incidence of fibroids. Smokers may slightly increase the rate of developing fibroids, but that's very slight, maybe an extra 1-2% risk, although smoking's bad in general, don't get me wrong. But that is one of the lifestyle factors that are associated with it. Exercise, doesn't matter. Alcohol consumption, doesn't matter. So really, these are tissues that, again, 50% of the time a woman has this. So it could be part of the normal changes inside the uterine environment. So there's really nothing in terms of diet or lifestyle that contributes to it.
But, you know, our body is made up of so many different places that we have muscles. And why do we not hear, or maybe it's just because I don't hear about it, but why do we not hear about fibroids and other muscle organs?
That's a great question. And the one thing you have to keep in mind is just how amazing an organ the uterus is. Unlike any other muscle, what you ask it to do, and it's a muscle. You take it, you look at it in the microscope, it's got smooth muscles, lines, the whole thing. In a non-pregnant state, that uterus is maybe from the entrance to the cervix to the top of the uterus 2.5 centimeters. But at 40 weeks of gestation, it's up to the xiphoid. It's 40 centimeters in size. No other structure in our body accommodates that. Nothing has that kind of pliancy and the strength. And then after it stretches to that size, it's got to have regular spontaneous contractions to expel a child. There's no other organ in the body like it. So that it has this propensity to develop these nodular structures to a greater extent than any other muscular or musculoskeletal structures is problematic, but not surprising. It's a very unique organ.
It's always The more I learn about reproduction in general and the reproductive tract, the more it just seems miraculous. I'm at the point now where I think if anybody gets pregnant, how in the world does that happen?
I think that myself sometimes too, and all that's involved between ovulation, the fallopian tube, picking up the egg and having intercourse at the right time, and then having fertilization and the embryo traveling, finding a good place to attach free of fibroids. Oh, yeah. Believe me.
It's
a wonder. It's a wonder. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it is, and it's something that I think it's really helpful for us sometimes to stop and acknowledge, particularly those of us who are involved with infertility and infertility patients. It's easy to forget that the miracle that it is, even that it ever happens at all. You know.
Yeah.
Let me pause for a moment and to remind everybody that this show, Creating a Family, as well as all the other resources that we produce, and we do produce 4 to 5 pieces of new content every week to try to help those who are struggling with infertility and struggling to create their family. All of this happens because of the generous support of our partners. And these are clinics who believe in organizations, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the patient community. And one of our wonderful partners is Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. They are a full-service fertility center specializing in vitro fertilization, egg donation, egg and embryo freezing, LGBTQIA family building, reproductive surgeries, male reproductive medicine. Their goal is to provide highly individualized patient care through their staff of course, reproductive endocrinologists, as well as urologists and a support team, and that is RMA Associates of New York, or RMA of New York would be the better way of saying it. So back to the questions. We've just talked about how it's kind of a miracle any of us get pregnant. So let's talk about how fibroids can cause, or let me ask, can fibroids cause infertility? And then let's also talk about how fibroids might interfere with carrying a baby to term.
Well, absolutely. So, as far as the fertility side of fibroids go, again, we're going back to the size and location. One of the basic tests that we do to evaluate the uterus is a hysterosalpingogram. That's where you go to a radiologist and they instill a dye that outlines the uterine cavity and then outlines both of the fallopian tubes. So let's say on the initial exam, I see that there's a 2 to 3 centimeter fibroid. It's near the uterine cavity, maybe up by the fallopian tube because it stretches stretches enough. I look to the hysterosalpingogram, and what I want to see is a nice uterine cavity that doesn't show indentation from the fibroid. So if the fibroid enters the uterine cavity, instead of a nice triangle, you would see a bowing out of one side. You'd see the fibroid actually distorting the contour of the uterine surface. And in that case, I know that that part of the uterus is unavailable for healthy implantation. Or I could see that the dye is not passing through one of the fallopian tubes where that fibroid, let's say the fibroid was on the upper right and the right fallopian tube is occluded. Well, here we go. This fibroid may be the culprit as far as closure of that fallopian tube goes. So there are subsequent tests that need to be done to determine the degree of involvement of the fibroid and the reproductive tract. Now, if that fibroid enters the uterine cavity, then I would recommend a surgical intervention. If that fibroid blocks the fallopian tube, I would recommend a surgical intervention. If that fibroid, or when I do the initial evaluation, is large, if it's more than 4 or 5 centimeters, and that's about the size of a baseball, then I'm paying particular attention to how big that uterine cavity is, because if the uterus is splayed out over this fibroid, it's stretched out, and again, that's not ideal. And these are things that are assessed by a combination of exam, sonography, and the hysterosalpingogram, the HSG. And in those cases, therapy would be indicated. And the primary treatment for fibroids in the setting of attempting to conceive is surgical, unfortunately. There are medical therapies that one could consider if pregnancy is not a consideration, but the majority of treatment options for fibroids as far as fertility goes does involve the surgical correction or surgical removal of these fibroids.
So if it's in the wall itself and it is not the wall of the uterus, the muscular wall, and it's not protruding into the uterus, that growth inside the muscular wall is not protruding in, then generally that is not going to be the cause of, that's not going to cause problems with conception. But if it's
correct.
Growing,
so if,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so but if it's growing and jutting out, or you said that sometimes it can actually be growing inside the uterus itself and attached to the muscular wall,
right.
Both of those are reasons for concern. One, because as you, I think you mentioned at the very beginning, if it's growing inside the uterus and just attached to the wall, it's acting like an IUD. It's causing irritation, and which would, I think the thought is that how that works is that it hinders implantation. So did I understand you correctly?
That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
Okay. So as far as infertility, it sounds like if you're struggling to conceive and you have fibroids, number one, you got to figure out if the fibroids are the cause of the problem. They may or may not be. But if they are, and if they are, it is usually dependent upon the location and the size.
Correct.
And then if that's the case, then usually surgery. But we have also been told that surgery, surgery on the uterine cavity or in the uterus itself, can also interfere, the scar tissue can interfere with implantation. So how much of a risk is that?
Right. Every surgical decision is a matter of risk and benefit. Clearly, if there was a suitable medical alternative, we'd employ those first. But a lot of the medical therapies influence the hormone environment of the reproductive tract, whether it's an antiprogesterone or whether it's a medication that completely shuts down the reproductive tract to shrink fibroids. You can't conceive with those medications in place.
Right. Yeah.
So you can get a temporary relief. Right. Yeah. You get a temporary relief from the symptoms, but the minute you stop the medication in an effort to conceive, well, the fibroid's still there. It's going to return. It's going to go back to its original size, and it's going to have the same issue. So unfortunately, as it stands now, there are no successful medical therapies. This is a mass. It's in the wrong spot, and it has to be removed. Now, the good news is that with minimally invasive procedures and robotic surgical procedures, the cure rate of fibroids is exceptionally high, over 95%, and the risk of damage to the uterus or the surrounding structures, the bladder and bowel, less than 2-3%. So if 95% of the time I can achieve a better uterine environment, as opposed to the 2-3% of the time where I may damage the uterus, the decision for surgery is usually the one that's recommended.
Yeah, that would make sense. Now let's talk about carrying a baby to term. Let's say you, mm-hmm. I mean, some women don't realize they even have fibroids until after they're pregnant.
That's correct.
Yeah, I mean, so let's say you're already.
I remember doing cesarean sections and at the time of delivery finding massive fibroids that were completely asymptomatic. And,
yeah, and clearly didn't interfere with conception.
Clearly, exactly.
Yeah, let me read this question we have from Aisha. She said, should I try to get pregnant if I know I have fibroids, or should I get treatment to get rid of them first? So that kind of that leads us into the discussion of pregnancy with fibroids. What are the risks?
That's a great question. So again, you have to be methodical. Just because you have fibroids doesn't mean you need to have surgery, nor does it mean that you can't get pregnant. So have the evaluation. Get an ultrasound done. Catalog the fibroids. Get an HSG done to make sure that the uterine cavity is healthy and both tubes are clear. And then don't lose the forest for the trees. Make sure that you get a sperm count as well as an evaluation of your ovarian reserve to make sure that the eggs are healthy. And if the uterine cavity is okay, tubes are clear, egg quality is good, sperm quality is good, try to conceive. Absolutely try to conceive.
So the risks of being able, let's say you, I assume in Aisha's case that she knows she has fibroids.
Mm-hmm.
I read her question to say, is she, and I might have misread it, I read it to say that she was worried about would it interfere with the baby being able to grow and be born and be carried to full term. Can fibroids interfere with that?
Well, it depends on their size. Now, if, you know, assuming that she does have fibroids, if they're small and they're located on the periphery, they don't enter the uterine cavity, then they should not interfere with her ability to get or stay pregnant. Now, if it's a large fibroid, it's you know, let's say it's over 5 centimeters, it's distorting the shape of the uterine cavity, or it's in a bad position as far, is it a vaginal fibroid, as you were alluding to before, is it down low by the cervix? Well, you can tell that on physical exam. You can say, you know, there's no way that you will be able to deliver with this 5-centimeter fibroid low in the uterus because it's going to obstruct the birth canal that you need to take care of before you go ahead and try to conceive. So that's why a sonographic evaluation, HSG, a basic understanding of the anatomy, the location, and size of the fibroids is necessary to answer that question. But, again, in the majority of cases, she should be okay.
And so women with fibroids more likely to end up with a C-section, just comparing them to the general population?
That is in the data. But right now, cesarean section rates, unfortunately, are fairly high.
Yeah.
So, you know, the call to do a cesarean section, you know, the 30-40% rates in some hospitals,
yeah.
It's hard to say whether the fibroids are actually causing a problem or whether they're looking to avoid a potential problem and recommend the cesarean section. So I would say that if I had to give an estimate based on the data that's out there, having a fibroid doubles your risk of a cesarean section.
And you're right, though. The risk is already pretty high. All right. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that given how commonly cesarean sections are done, I don't always know whether it's because of the fibroid itself or because of the fear of the fibroid. So those are two different
point.
Issues.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And just the fact, and you know, honestly, there are a number of women who would prefer to have a C-section, so that also factors in and concern,
oh,
and the woman's concern and all of that it becomes an issue. All right, we've alluded a lot to the different ways to medically treat uterine fibroids, and we've talked about surgical removal and the high success rate and the low risk rate. So certainly surgical, but as you've said many times in this hour, the surgery is not always indicated, and it really depends on symptoms and as well as your goals if you're trying to get pregnant, and that's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But are there ways? So let's talk about some of the non-surgical ways. You've mentioned hormone treatments. What hormone mm-hmm. treatments are primarily? Is birth control pills the one that is primarily prescribed?
They are, but, you know, the data for birth control pills is somewhat equivocal, and that's because fibroids are not homogeneous. They vary. They have different receptors. Some have a greater abundance of estrogen, some receptors, progesterone receptors, so they're hormonally diverse. So you really can't tell by looking at a fibroid as to what its potential to response to the birth control pill would be. In other words, some patients are going to benefit, other patients don't. It may be worthwhile to consider a trial of them to see if the symptoms improve. If they don't, then you move on to another therapy. But the birth control pill is a good place to start because they're easily accessible, they're relatively inexpensive, and they're pretty well tolerated. So we usually start with that to see if that doesn't work. If it works. If that doesn't work, then the next step would really be using an anti-progesterone agent similar to RU486 or using Lupron, which essentially shuts down the reproductive tract. But these are fairly aggressive medical therapies, and there could be some side effects that are associated with them. So usually we utilize those if the patient really may need surgery, but let's see what we can do as kind of a last resort before surgery is implemented. So the birth control pill is fairly commonly used, and then the next step where you're using RU486 or intervals of Lupron, that has to be a lengthy discussion in terms of what the possible benefits are, because, again, once you stop these medications, the fibroids usually return.
And these, as you point out, these medications are not without their own side effects.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. What about, I've been reading about radio frequency ablation. Has there been much research on that? What is it first, and is there much support that says that that's something that's coming on the horizon, or is it already here?
That's a great question. You know, radio frequency ablation is essentially using a localized pulse of heat energy to cause necrosis, or cause the fibroid essentially to die and involute. The literature out there seems promising, but again, it's very specialized, and you have to go to a center that really does a lot of these types of interventions. And then the birth outcome and data from these cases, again, it's not the largest numbers that are available. I think for fibroids that are small, and let's look at it this way. If it's in the uterine cavity, that's a very delicate area. That's where the endometrium has to form every month. I would be very reluctant to use radio frequency energy inside the uterine cavity.
If I had wondered about that. Yeah, it seems like
I would not do it for that.
But
if it's a fibroid, let's say, in the wall of the uterus, and it's pushing up against the bladder or causing mass effects, and it's not in the uterine cavity itself, then that would be a case where you'd want to consider that. But again, you have to be careful.
What about ablations in general? First of all, please tell us what an ablation is in general, and then is that an effective treatment?
Ablation in general is not a particularly effective treatment for fibroids in women who are considering conception, because essentially it's a fibroid that's causing excessive bleeding, and so what you're doing is essentially is you're blading the endometrial surface so that bleeding can no longer occur. That unfortunately damages the endometrium that you need for implantation. So ablation is the application of electrical or heat energy to the endometrial surface so that you decrease the intensity of bleeding associated with the fibroid. I would not recommend that if you're considering conception.
But if your primary symptom that you're seeking treatment for and you don't plan on getting pregnant, primary symptom is excessive bleeding, it's something to consider. Is that, did I hear you right on that?
That is correct. That is correct.
But after an ablation, and there are different ways, radio frequency is just one, but there are different other types of ablation,
right.
It sounds like. So after
radio frequency ablation is not usually utilized in the uterine cavity. That's done for a fibroid that's in the wall of the uterus, or perhaps it's a fibroid that you can develop them on stalks that come off the uterus and compress other tissues, such as bladder. So that's where radio frequency energies can be safely utilized. So ablations are usually done in the uterine cavity with essentially a ball that goes up and down the endometrial surface and applies either electrical or heat energy to damage the endometrium so that it no longer bleeds.
And can people, after that happens, is it possible the next year, 2 years, 6 months, whatever, for the endometrium to regrow and to be able to have a surface for implantation?
Well, usually if you are doing this to stop bleeding, you essentially are removing more than 90% of the endometrium. So you are intentionally, in effect, sterilizing the uterus.
That's what I wanted.
Subsequent to that degree of intervention, it's very unlikely that the endometrium is going to recover.
Okay, so that is only a treatment if you are finished with childbearing.
Childbearing, yes.
Yeah, that's not child rearing, childbearing. Yes, that's what I said.
Childbearing.
I did it wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you may still be right in the thick of the child rearing business, but that getting pregnant business is a little different. Okay. Are there any alternative medical treatments that have been seen to be effective at treating uterine fibroids?
I mean, I've had patients look into acupuncture, look into herbal therapies, but again, temporary relief at best, unfortunately. Long-term relief from symptoms I really haven't seen, and, you know, restoration of fertility also I haven't seen.
Okay, and that's,
again,
you know,
it's a mass. It's tissue. It's got a, you know, and the reason that it's primarily causing a problem is an anatomical problem, not specifically a hormonal one, where alternative therapies may be a little bit more useful. But for fibroids, because it's a mass, they really don't bring much to the table.
Okay. All right. And at what point, if there's a hormonal connection, which we know there is, to fibroids, when a woman goes through menopause, does that take care of the fibroids become either less of a problem or no problem at all?
That's a great point. Yeah. Actually, within about 6 months to a year after cessation of menses, the fibroids are no longer an issue.
I guess if you're trying to conceive...
But that oftentimes that may be too much to ask of anybody, especially if they're symptomatic. But in theory, without estrogen and progesterone stimulating the growth of these fibroids after menopause, it's not really an issue unless they're, you know, they were big to begin with and they continue to push against the bladder or bowel.
Oh, okay, so they don't necessarily completely go away. They just aren't going to necessarily
right.
be growing because they're not being fed through any of the hormones. But if they're already a problem... then they're going to continue to, they're going to stay. They're not going
to shrink.
In
some cases, they will not shrink. They undergo degeneration. And some of the time, sometimes that can be a calcific degeneration where the tissues inside essentially become calcified, so they don't really shrink at all.
Yeah, but that is something to think about, depending on your age, and most of our audience is younger, so this is less of an issue, but depending on your age, you might think, okay, in 5 years, I probably this is not going to be much of an issue. Therefore, do I want to do the surgery and, you know, that type of... How involved is the surgery as far as hospital stay, limited activity, and stuff like that?
It is a fairly involved surgery with robotic approaches now. In other words, you do the procedure through small incisions in the abdomen. The length of time that you're in the hospital has been greatly reduced to maybe 1 or 2 days or maybe even going home right after the procedure. Recovery times have shortened from 4 to 6 weeks now to about 1 to 10 days. It is significantly reduced, but it's still a major surgery. If I were having mild to moderate symptoms and I saw a horizon of 3 to 4 years before I would be entering the menopause, I would probably stick it out.
When is a hysterectomy the preferred treatment, or is it ever?
Well, it depends on the size. If the fibroids are extremely large, then performing a myomectomy, which is simply removal of the fibroids, may be technically impossible. It may be better in terms of blood loss, hospital stay, simply have the hysterectomy. Certainly, if you're approaching menopause, if you have large, bulky fibroids, then a hysterectomy or a supracervical hysterectomy, which is a minimally invasive procedure, may be the preferred route simply because your recovery may be improved. Your blood loss certainly will be lower. So it's a discussion that you should have with your surgeon considering which approach is best. Now, if it's just 1 or 2 isolated fibroids, I just have the myomectomy. But if there are multiple large fibroids, then I would... A hysterectomy needs to be part of the discussion.
And we have another question came in that asks, is it possible to remove fibroids during a cesarean section?
It's possible only if, but it's not recommended. The amount of blood flow through the uterus in at term is prodigious. So if you enter the uterine cavity or you enter the muscle of the uterus, you get a lot more bleeding than you'd like to see. If it's necessary to deliver the baby, if it's in the lower segment, you can't access it anyway, you got to take out the fibroid, but it's not something that surgeons like to do.
So I don't know the impetus of this question, but I can imagine from my – I would be thinking, okay, if I'm going to have surgery anyway,
exactly.
Let's just do one surgery. Let's one knock me
get
out.
Get it all done.
Get it all done. And you know, you might want to do a few sort of cosmetics while we're at it. You know, let's do anything we can.
Operating on the uterus at term is a risky proposition. Again, it has a lot of blood flow at term, and it's not something that most surgeons would willingly take to do electively.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. If you have to in an emergency, you're doing it, but it's not something you would choose to do. Hence why if you know you have fibroids, thinking about this before pregnancy makes sense so that you can avoid that possibility. All right. I mentioned that you are listening to Creating a Family. Today we're talking about fibroids and other uterine issues, somewhat in honor of National Fibroid Month, which is July. Another one of our partners, I mentioned earlier that this show and all of our resources really could not happen without our wonderful partners who believe in our mission. So another one of our wonderful partners is Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years. They are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. Only one in 200 applicants make it through their screening process to become a donor. All right, today we're talking with Dr. Tamroy Mukherjee and about fibroids. He is one of the founding partners of RMA New York. Dr. Mukherjee, we've beaten fibroids to death. We have talked about them, so let's move on to other uterine issues that can cause problems both, and I want to talk about problems both in general as well as problems specifically when you're trying to get pregnant. Our audience is primarily people who have moved to thinking about trying to get pregnant and are beginning to have trouble. And that's how they Google and find us or go on to iTunes and find us. So although that is the predominance of our audience, I would still like to talk about issues in general that can happen, and then we'll segue into talking about if they can or cannot affect fertility or pregnancy. So what are some other you said at the beginning how phenomenal, and I couldn't agree with you more, the uterus is just as an organ, but even as phenomenal as it is, things, or maybe because it's such a complex organ, a lot of things can go wrong. What are some of the common ones?
Well, besides fibroids, another common issue inside the uterus that could be a problem are uterine polyps. Much like other structures, you can have polyps in the colon and polyps in other portions of the digestive and reproductive tract. But a polyp can also develop inside the uterine cavity, but the difference being it's not a nodular growth. It's essentially just a mass-occupying lesion. Very rarely is it a cancer or anything like that. I think of it more like a skin tag that develops inside the uterine cavity. Now, you have to keep in mind that the uterus itself is small, but the area where an embryo implants is even smaller. It's essentially the upper half of the uterus, so it's 1 centimeter from the top of the uterine cavity to the midpoint of the uterine cavity and about 1.5 centimeters across. I mean, it's literally the size of a postage stamp. So if you were to have a 1 centimeter polyp that's sitting right where the embryo wants to grow, that could be a problem. So in those cases, a minor procedure, I wouldn't even call it a surgery, a procedure to remove the polyp is undertaken. So again, you can improve the real estate, if you will, for an embryo to implant. Aside from polyps, there could be structural abnormalities of the uterus. I described the uterus as a triangle before, but there are congenital or issues from birth where you see that the uterus is smaller. So instead of a triangular appearance to the uterus, it's essentially more like a horn where there's only a smaller uterine remnant that is left, and that can complicate efforts to conceive. The other issue is scarring of the uterine cavity, whether it's from prior surgical procedures, uterine infections. You can scar the uterine cavity and form a condition known as Asherman syndrome. And again, scarring is problematic because it denies the embryo a location for a successful implantation. So in that case, surgery would also need to be undertaken.
Let me ask a question about that. What you were mentioning, some of the things, say them again, what can result in scarring of the uterine cavity and causing Asherman syndrome?
Sure, prior instrumentation of the uterine cavity. Things like a D&C or a cesarean section do increase your risk for Asherman's. Uterine infection can cause Asherman syndrome as well.
Okay, and so when you have scarring, and obviously, or maybe not obviously, but it makes sense to think that an embryo is not going to be able to implant on scar tissue. What
Correct.
Does surgery do? Doesn't surgery cause more scars?
Well, surgery always has the risk of more scarring. Again, it's a matter of risk and benefit. If that scar is already there, then pregnancy rates are low. So what you're trying to accomplish with the surgery is to take the scar out, and then in some cases place a balloon in to separate the walls of the uterus, giving it a chance to heal and hopefully regenerate the endometrium in those spots that were affected by scar. And a good prognostic indicator is the extent of scarring. So prior to the procedure, you usually undergo either a saline ultrasound or, again, that hysterosalpingogram that I spoke of earlier, and you can quantify the percentage of scarring. So if less than 25% of the uterine cavity is scarred, surgical correction rates are over 90%. If more than 50% or severe uterine scarring is noted, then surgical correction rates are poor, unfortunately, less than 5 to 10%. And in between those two extremes, you know, usually you're going to have about a 50 to 70% success rate. So, Ashman, this is fairly serious.
Yeah, very. You had mentioned before the when a malformed uterus, horn-shaped, I believe. What causes that? Is that just a freak?
Oh, that's just an accident. Yeah, okay. It's a congenital abnormality, so nobody really has a specific idea of what the causes are.
What about, we sometimes hear women who say they have bifurcated a uterus. Yes, explain what that is.
That's on the other extreme of that. So, yeah, you kind of have to visualize how the uterus forms in the first place. So, as an embryo, the uterus forms from essentially two tubes that are parallel to each other. So the midpoint of the tubes merge, and the tissue between the tubes gets absorbed to create a single uterine cavity. The upper portion of the tubes fall out to the side and become the fallopian tubes, which pick up the egg. And the bottom half of the tube, bottom third of the tube, I should say, forms the upper third of the vagina. And again, that septum, or those two tubes where they meet and touch each other, that tissue in the middle gets absorbed to create a single chamber. So with a unicornial uterus, which was that that first uterine abnormality that I spoke of, one of those tubes was completely absent. So you form a smaller uterus and one fallopian tube off one side. With a bicornuate uterus, those tubes only partially merge, and then you have two separate uterine horns that come off on the left and the right with their own respective fallopian tubes. So you can get any combination and variation of this. You can have a unicornuate uterus on one side that has a full uterine cavity and fallopian tube, but the other side only has a rudimentary structure called the rudimentary horn, which is just a small mass of tissue that's trying to form a uterine cavity but doesn't. You can have two full uteruses on either side with their own fallopian tubes, and that's a bicornuate uterus. They can fuse, and the tissue in the middle remains, and you get a septate uterus. So all of these abnormalities that are seen really come from the unique origin of how the uterus develops in the first place.
Okay, so how do all of, which I think, would it be fair to say that what you just described were structural abnormalities in the uterus itself?
Yes.
How do structural abnormalities, such as the ones you've mentioned, impact pregnancy? And I realize that the answer will depend on which one. Or the severity, I suppose. But for a woman who finds out that she has this, can she get pregnant?
Yes, she can. And, you know, these are difficult conversations, but in most cases, you can conceive. What you have to evaluate is just how small the uterine horn is. I've seen uterine horns that are just as big as regular uteruses, so I'm not that concerned about getting or staying pregnant. However, the obstetrical issues later in the pregnancy, not the first or second trimester perhaps, become a greater likelihood of a breech presentation because the baby just does not have as much room in that uterine horn. It's plenty big to get pregnant and get through that second trimester, but in the third trimester where the pregnancy, you know, where the uterus gets about 40 centimeters, that requires a very high degree of uterine compliance that a uterus simply half the size can't accommodate. So the uterine cavity is smaller, there's a higher incidence of breech presentations, and a much, much higher cesarean rate. You were talking close to 100%, the need for a cesarean section. In worst-case scenarios where the uterine horns are smaller, there is a higher risk of second trimestral loss of pregnancy and miscarriage. Unfortunately, there's not really any surgical correction that you can offer. So the history of these pregnancies is that you may have several second trimester, and that's between 12 weeks and 24 weeks, losses, but then ultimately the uterus distends enough where it can accommodate a pregnancy that will last into hopefully 28, 30, or even 32 weeks before delivery.
But you need to assess that the risk of that, of having an extreme preemie.
Right. Exactly. I mean, if the uterine horns are extremely small, then you may need to consider surrogacy.
Does infertility treatment necessarily help with someone with one of these structural abnormalities?
In some cases, if the uterus itself is, the uterine horn is large, but the fallopian tube doesn't form properly, then performing in vitro fertilization with a single embryo being transferred can assist. Because if the fallopian tube, again, is part of this uterine abnormality, remembering that the fallopian tube and the uterus arise from the same embryonic structure, you may have an affected fallopian tube. So if the tube doesn't work properly, then you're not going to have successful in vivo fertilization. That's
right.
Where IVF can be of use.
So that's the primary reason. Is there a way through IVF to, in the IVF, is the egg would be removed, it would be fertilized outside the uterus, and then there would be a transfer where the embryo at that point would be transferred back in. Is there a way to transfer, to use that method, I liked your analogy of saying it was the size of a postage stamp, which is really pretty amazing when you think about it. And so is there a way to target that postage stamp with the tube that you're using to transfer the embryo that would up the chances?
Oh, we do. We do routinely. When we do IVF, we place the tip of the catheter in that sweet spot, if you will. So we see where the tip of the catheter is, and we advance it to within a centimeter of the top of the uterus. So we take advantage of that during during IVF embryo transfer.
But would that be a reason that a woman might want to consider IVF if she's got a structural abnormality? Because the doctor may be able to better target the sweet spot than nature, or is that really not worth the risk and expense and all that of IVF?
Well, typically what's done is if the evaluation shows a reasonably sized uterine cavity and a big enough fallopian tube, that medical therapy is undertaken for 2 to 3 months, and if that's unsuccessful, then we go on to IVF. So IVF is always part of the discussion, but it's not the first treatment option for uterine abnormalities.
Yeah, and so it would be highly individualized whether or not that would be helpful or not.
Right.
Makes sense.
Yeah, simply because you don't know how receptive the uterus is until you try. But if 2 to 3 months goes by and medical therapy and even insemination doesn't work, then I think you've built up some empiric evidence that you need to be more aggressive. So the approach to IVF is still utilizing natural and medical therapy before proceeding to IVF, even with uterine structural abnormalities.
Okay. And one last question, and I think it's probably less of an issue now, or I hope it is, and that is DES, or what they used to call DES babies. It was a drug.
Oh, yeah, that's...
Yeah, given for women supposedly to help with miscarriage, or was it nausea? I'm not even sure. It may have been nausea, pregnancy symptoms. Anyway, and their daughters, and actually their sons as well, had a lot of structural abnormalities to the reproductive tract. Since DES is not used anymore, is that really something you no longer see in your practice?
I don't see it because the age, we've kind of aged out of that population. It was usually given for a history of miscarriage and vaginal bleeding associated with it, the thought being that, well, estrogen is an important hormone, So we use an estrogen analog, and we should be able to help everybody reduce their miscarriage rates. Unfortunately, they, you know, because it's an estrogen analog, they're developing these embryonic structures that I was speaking about before that are important in the formation of the uterus, the reproductive tract, vagina, and so forth. They're also sensitive to the effects of DES, and you increase the rates of certain cancers because of the developmental abnormalities that are associated with this estrogen analog.
Yeah, it's good to know that you're not seeing it. I wouldn't have thought that it would, because you're right. That I think it was given in the 50s and 60s. So
yeah,
these women have aged out of your population, or childbearing in general. Right. Well,
right.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tanmoy Mukherjee, for being our guest today to talk about fibroids and other uterine issues. Keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to check with your infertility professional. Now, I know that a number of you are going to want to reach out and get more information about Dr. Mukherjee, R of RMA New York, and you can do that by going to their website, which is rmany.com, rmany.com. Thanks for joining me today, and I will see you next week.
I'm here with Joy Dahl of Creighton University to discuss an innovative way Creighton is teaching the next generation of healthcare providers. Joy, please explain what collaborative care means and how it will help patients in the future.
Collaborative care is when healthcare providers intentionally work together to provide the best patient outcome. Where we typically go and see our physician, instead, we're working to teach our students that you, as a patient, go see the healthcare team.
So how can someone learn more about collaborative care education at Creighton University?
To learn more, go to our website, creighton.edu, to read more about our leadership in this emerging field.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn. Ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn. Tell people to stay off the lawn. Compare it to your neighbor's lawn. And complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance. Which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.